Blog Talk Radio.
Hi everyone, this is Justine Rotolo. I'm also known as Miss ADD. I want to welcome everyone to the program today. I'm so excited to have Natasha Tracy back on with us. She was with us in 2014 and we had the most phone calls on the show ever. So I want to remind everyone who wants to call in and talk to Natasha today, the phone number is area code 917-889-7025. And so now, without further ado, I'm going to bring Natasha on the line.
Hi, Justine.
Hi, Natasha. How are you?
I'm doing really well. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Excited about having you on.
Great. Love to hear that.
So let's talk about bipolar disorder.
Sure. What would you like to talk about specifically?
Well, I think I've got a number of people that are in my support groups that struggling with hypomania, bipolar 2.
Okay.
And I was wondering if maybe we could start there and you could talk about some coping strategies for them.
Okay. So in bipolar type 2, and I do have that particular brand of bipolar, we experience something called hypomania, which is less severe than mania. So mania is typically considered a life-threatening condition, whereas hypomania is typically not. Now, hypomania and mania actually have exactly the same symptoms, and the only difference is severity. So in hypomania, you can experience many things. My personal experience often involves really fast talking and tending to think that I'm a genius and tending to think that other people are stupid and writing, you know, reams and reams of stuff that I think is brilliant at the time, which may, of course, all turn out to be nothing. It's a huge amount of energy that I don't know what to do with. And so it ends up starting a lot of random projects that I can't finish and not sleeping. But everyone's experience of hypomania is going to be different. But there are things that I personally do to deal with my own hypomania that people might find helpful. So for me, the most important thing in hypomania is to realize that it's happening. So self-awareness is really critical. So in order to have that, you have to know your own personal symptoms of hypomania. So do you tend to feel hypersexual? Do you tend to be a risk taker? You know, what is your personal symptom profile for hypomania? You need to know that about yourself, and you need to watch for the early signs that that's actually coming on. So for me, for example, if I do find that I have a lot of excess energy and I truly can't sleep at night, in spite of the fact that I've taken my medication just like I always do, I know that hypomania is probably there, even if I haven't seen the other signs show up yet. Because, of course, many people do have a hard time seeing their own signs, which is why it's really helpful to have empirical markers to say, empirically, I am not sleeping, therefore something is wrong. It's impossible not to notice that you're not sleeping. Something else, like a risk-taking behavior, that might be harder for you to notice. But it's all about knowing yourself and knowing what your normal is. So when I see that hypomania is coming on for me, I personally find that it's really important to stem the tide of hypomania immediately. So I don't want to wait for it to get out of control, because what happens, in my opinion, is that hypomania feeds on hypomania. So if you have it, it just gets worse and worse and worse the more you leave it there. Now, some people may actually want that. I don't agree that that's the best thing to do. I believe it's important to notice it right at the beginning and then stem the tide of it as soon as you can. So for me, what I typically do is I take a PRN medication, so a medication that I use as needed. And this type of medication for me helps me to slow down, it helps to calm my energy, and it helps me to sleep. And I find that if I can actually induce sleep that night, oftentimes, if I do get a full night's sleep, I can wake up the next morning and things are much better, much fresher, and that hypomania might even be gone.
Could I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
What would be the, give me some types of PRN medication.
Sure. So it's definitely going to be different for different people, but what I'm personally thinking of is a benzodiazepine type of medication. So that
okay.
would be something like an Ativan, for example.
Okay.
That would
okay.
be the kind of medication that I would think of in this scenario. But for some people, it might also be something like an antipsychotic. That also might be very successful in an as-needed kind of basis.
Oh, can you take them that way?
You can. It's not
oh.
as common, but some
okay.
people do find it useful. Because
okay,
one
because
of the things about... Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that some of the people that I know have addiction related to their
yep.
bipolar. So
yes.
So an Ativan type of drug would be out of the question for them. And I'm
yes.
very
and
interested... in the antipsychotic as PRN. I didn't know that, so yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely an issue, and I feel for those people, absolutely. And what we see with antipsychotics is it's often the side effect that it induces sleep that is really useful for people, especially in the scenario that you're talking about.
Wow, okay. That's great. I didn't know that. So you're saying that when you have a good night's sleep then, you get up the next day and... most of the time, the hypomania symptoms have lessened?
Yes. For me, getting a full night's sleep is very powerful in terms of affecting a hypomanic mood. If I don't sleep, for example, if I'm not successful at sleeping, then it will definitely get worse the next day. But that one
okay.
good night of sleep will often mean that the next day the symptoms have lessened and maybe even gone away completely. I do know it obviously is different for different people, but that's what works for me.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about the cycling in bipolar?
Yeah, so I'm a pretty rapid cycler, but on average, people with bipolar disorder actually have fewer than 4 mood episodes a year. So that means that in untreated bipolar disorder, moods actually last for months.
Wow.
So that is really the norm is what we call that. However, some people do cycle much more rapidly. They may
right.
only have a mood that lasts a few weeks, for example. And then there are people who cycle even more rapidly than that may have a mood only for a day.
Mm.
We call these people ultradian cyclers. It's
wow.
not a term you hear all the time, but I personally am one. I can easily have hypomania that only lasts a day, and then I can easily, you know, fall down from that hypomania into a depression the next day, which is what I typically observe in a cycle. So I always tell people, the higher you fly, the farther there is to fall, and the bigger the crater you make when you get there. So that's one of the reasons that it's so critical to stop that hypomania immediately, because you're going to pay for it with less depression later. That's my experience. So
that is very interesting. Thank you.
That is definitely the cycling that I see. So, for example, I get hypomanic often when I'm really, really stressed out. That can happen to me. That stress can build into energy, and that energy can build into hypomania, and then that all will wrap itself up, and when the hypomania peaks, then I will get depressed right afterwards. That's the typical
wow.
cycling.
Wow, okay. I'd like to ask a question, too, about medication. So I do understand that sometimes it can be very difficult to get the right cocktail of medication.
Yes,
when
absolutely.
You get that right cocktail, what I hear you saying, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that even though you have that right cocktail of meds, you can still go into a hypomanic episode.
Yes, that's true. So my medications are quite successful at dealing with hypomania, but I do still get it every once in a while, usually when life events are, you know, are unusual. That's when I will usually experience a hypomanic episode. And yes, even though I do consider my medications to be successful, I do still experience hypomania, and I do still experience fairly severe depression.
Wow. Okay. That's a big complaint of a lot of people that I hear. In fact, one woman last week in one of our groups told us that her son took them 10 years to find the right medication for him.
And I'm very sorry to hear that. I do hear stories like that all the time. And it isn't unusual for it to take years to find a successful medication. I don't want people to think it's hopeless because it absolutely isn't, but it can take a long time. You know, in my experience, it has taken years in many cases for me to find a successful medication, and then unfortunately that medication stops working at some point down the road, and then it can take me years to find another successful cocktail. So I certainly would never want to put out the message that it's not going to work for people. In fact, I would put out the exact opposite message, which is that even if it's not working for you today, that doesn't mean that it's not going to work for you tomorrow, a month from now, a year from now. And the thing that's really critical is to keep going. It's that, you know, it's that stick-to-itiveness and that being willing to work with your doctor to try new options that will get you better in the end.
So how do you think someone can be their best advocate for dealing with a psychiatrist?
Well, I think dealing with a psychiatrist is always a tricky thing. I have found that it can be very difficult to deal with someone who is an authority figure and someone who has considerable power. They may feel like they have a God complex. They may not listen to you because you're a patient. They may discount your opinion. I mean, there's all kinds of issues when you have a power imbalance like you see in the psychiatrist-patient relationship.
Yeah.
All that being said, I do think it's quite possible to have a positive relationship with your doctor. And I think that the first thing you can do to really help that is to really educate yourself about your disorder. Whatever it is, whatever your symptoms are, you really need to educate yourself on the facts. So you need to go to a really quality website, you know, that's the easiest way to do it, and get some really good quality facts about your particular disorder. Because then you're going to be able to talk to your doctor more in language that he or she is going to understand. So when you're able to put a name to the symptom, that's going to be more successful than if you just try to describe a feeling, which honestly the doctor may or may not understand because it's coming out of your head and not their head. So I think learning some terminology, and no one expects you to be a doctor. You're not a doctor, totally okay.
Right.
But learning some of the terminology is helpful so that you can have a conversation on even footing.
Right.
And
which
then what I think is really important is for people to really know what they want from a doctor. So if you walk in and you're thinking to yourself, I can't take this medication anymore, the side effects are too severe, then obviously what you're looking for from the doctor that particular day is a different medication. There has to be a plan because I cannot take this medication anymore. But what I can tell you is that not everyone is successful at communicating that desire, and so they actually leave the office without having had their needs met.
So why do you think someone isn't successful at being able to say that to their doctor?
I think often it's a matter of communication. You know, like I said, some doctors aren't very good at listening to you, and if you're feeling a bit intimidated by the doctor, and many of us do, that's completely normal, then you may not even be able to adequately express yourself on your own without adding a doctor who doesn't want to listen to you. So the critical thing there is to be as clear and precise and specific as possible. So one of the things I recommend for people is whatever you want out of an appointment, whatever you want to say to your doctor, write it down ahead of time.
That's great.
Because you might forget it in the moment. That would be really normal. And then you're going to leave without your needs met. So write it down ahead of time. And when you are sitting in front of that doctor, you take out that piece of paper and you say to the doctor, this is what I really need today. And you have your list, whatever it is. That's,
great.
I think, really powerful for people.
Yeah, that's a great idea. We have someone on the phone that wants to ask you a question.
All right.
Okay. Hang on one second. Can we put him on, honey, the first one? Okay. Okay. Jerry?
Hi.
Hi. Hi.
How are
Natasha,
you
this is Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Natasha. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Hi.
That's good. Okay, I have been diagnosed with bipolar, but I didn't know that was when I didn't know back then.
I'm doing well.
So what happened, I was taking medication, and it took me a while before I get to my the one that I like.
Yeah.
So now I'm taking Lexapro.
Okay.
And my question is, okay, this thing right here, they started me with 2.5 milligram per day, and take twice a day. Now I'm up to 5 milligram, and then I think it's not it served me well, but I'm not really, I think I need more. And then I'm moving from United States to go back to the Philippines. How could I get that medication?
Okay, so that's really two questions. So one, it sounds to me like you're not quite, you're not feeling like the medication is helping you as much as it could, right? So that's the first question. And to address that, you definitely need to work with your doctor, and increasing the dosage of that medication may be an option for you, but there are other options for you as well, such as adding an additional medication, because some medications will essentially make other medications more effective. So they almost turn up the effectiveness of other medications. So that may be an option for you, but you would need to work with your doctor to find the best one for you. If I personally was in your situation and I was diagnosed with bipolar and I was taking an antidepressant, which is what Lexapro is, I would be very concerned about having too big a dose of that, because antidepressants can cause cycling, hypomania, and mania in people with bipolar disorder. That would be my personal concern. Now, regarding your move and getting access to medication, I am sorry, but I just I don't know what to tell you about that, as that's just not my area. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. So what do you think the other medication that would be appropriate with this medication? I just have to work.
There are many options. One option would be Abilify, which is the generic name is aripiprazole. I know it's long. But that particular medication is an antipsychotic, and often a very small amount of that added to an antidepressant can be effective, and it's FDA approved to be used in that manner.
I took that already. It didn't work for me.
Did you take it in combination with another drug?
Yeah.
You didn't. It wasn't effective for you.
It was not effective. It just makes me worse.
Okay. So if that one doesn't work for you, there are other antipsychotics to try as well, because that's what doctors will typically go to, is either an antipsychotic or an anticonvulsant or mood stabilizer. I think if I had to guess, and I don't know for sure, you have to work with your doctor, but if I had to guess, I'd say you're going to have more likelihood of getting a positive response from an antipsychotic, but I don't know your history, so I can't say. But something like quetiapine, which the brand name is Seroquel, that would be another option possibly in bipolar disorder where someone is feeling like they're not getting the maximum benefit from the medication they're currently taking. And again, you'd see like a small dosage of that and helping your other medication.
Well, they prescribed me that also, Seroquel, and it did not work for me. But anyway, this is the one that helped me a lot. Ever since,
okay.
I've been taking this, so I might just increase the dosage. I'm gonna ask my doctor before I go before I go to overseas, because I've been moving home. And hopefully I'll get me a doctor that could prescribe me the same medication over there.
Yeah, I hope you can too. Good luck.
Thank you, Jerry. Natasha, we have Lori, who has a question for you about her meds.
Sure.
We're getting her on right now. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
Hi, Natasha. There's Lori.
Hi, Lori.
Hi. I had a few questions that fellow already answered for me, except how do you convince a doctor to start your medications slowly? Like, I've had three psychiatrists that just change the medications after 2 weeks, and I've done so much reading and on your blogs, and it says to wait 4 to 6 weeks for success. Do you believe that?
Yeah. That is a really great point that you're making right now. Some of us, myself included, are very sensitive to medications and medication changes.
Right.
So in studies, they tend to put people on fairly high dosage and ramp up the dosages really fast. I can tell you that's what they do in studies. And they do this for time reasons. They do this for all kinds of reasons. But that's not the schedule that works for, like, an average, normal, real human being. The schedule that will work for a real human being is often much, much slower. So basically, I would tell my doctor, if I had that problem, I would say, I tried increasing the dose, but I got way too many side effects, so I went back down on the dose, and I want to try a higher dose in another 3 weeks, for example, once my body has a chance to get used to the medication a little bit more. That's the kind of thing that I would say. So I would give it a try, and if it didn't work for me, then I'd go back down on the dosage.
Because I just feel like I'm at a dead end because nothing has worked over the last 8 years, and so unfortunately I got sucked into ECT. That didn't help, and now I'm just sitting at home going, I can't live like this for the rest of my life. This is just crazy. So I thought if I start with a new psychiatrist, maybe we can just go slowly and start introducing them again and hopefully looking out.
For me,
lithium worked for me.
Yeah, and then what happened?
Lithium. For 8 years I was fine, and then I had my thyroid removed. And it hasn't worked since. So now we've been working, is it my thyroid? So we're working on that, trying desiccated thyroid, but I'm still in a depression no matter what I do.
Well, I can, so just from my experience, it's been a cocktail that's been effective for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be what ends up being effective for you as well. And that's obviously really hard to find a cocktail because there's no studies on cocktails as a general rule.
Right.
So you just have to find the cocktail that works with your particular brand.
And hopefully if I go in to meet a new psychiatrist and I'm crying and I tell him what's been going on in my life for 10 years, he'll care enough to try what I think he should try or try something different than the norm.
Yeah, and you sound like you're really articulate. So I say be very vocal with the doctor and just say, look, I've had all these experiences, like X, Y, and Z, and they're not working for me. We need to try something different. Would you be willing to work with me on this treatment plan?
Yeah, because they don't really tell you how well ECT works or if it doesn't. And so when I come out of that treatment and there's nothing happening for me, it's like death would be my option. There's got to be something else besides ECT or after ECT that's not successful.
Well, I've had ECT as well. I had 9 treatments, and they weren't successful for me either. So I can tell you that sometimes they make it sound like ECT is the last-ditch effort, and if it doesn't work, you're going to die. Like, they make it sound like that. But that's not the reality of the situation. The reality of the situation is if ECT doesn't work for you, there are options for you, and it's not a reason to give up. You can do it.
Good. Thank you so much.
You're
welcome.
Thank you, Lori.
On Facebook so I can talk to you more often. Okay,
thanks for calling.
Thank you.
It was an honor to talk to you.
That's very sweet. Thank you.
Yeah. So I guess my question is this. Why do you think that in the world of schizophrenia, and I'm not saying, that it would be better to have schizophrenia, but what I notice is that the meds they seem to be able to find the right meds for most of these people that I've known or met. When they come off their meds is when there's a problem. With bipolar,
yeah.
And I know sometimes, why is it so hard, Natasha? Why is that across the board?
So I think the problem with bipolar is the fact that it is, in fact, bipolar, i.e. two. We don't have one problem. Essentially, we have two. We have
okay.
the elevations and we have the depressions. And medications are quite successful at addressing one or the other, but they're just not very successful at addressing both. And if you think about it, it does make sense. I mean, what drug would you ever take that would somehow bring up your mood and your mood down at the same time? Right?
Yeah.
When you think about
yeah.
that, that's a very difficult
yeah.
nut to crack. That
that's
would
very
be
helpful.
My
the way you explained it was very helpful because I never thought of it that way. But it's very frustrating for so many people. And I want to ask you, have you ever heard of TMS? Transcranial.
Yes. So,
okay. Does that work for bipolar?
So, yes. So what you're talking about is typically referred to as RTMS, which is repetitive
okay.
transcranial magnetic stimulation. And
right.
what that is a really fancy machine that uses a magnet over your head and creates an electrical field using a magnet that goes into your brain. And this is a non-invasive treatment that you don't actually feel while they're doing it. So you actually sit under this special machine for 20 minutes at a time, three times a day for a certain number of weeks. That's how RTMS works. Now, yes, RTMS can be effective, to the best of my knowledge, for bipolar depression. So it's not a treatment for bipolar en masse, but if bipolar depression is your main symptom and your main concern, then that would be a treatment option, I would say, definitely. The
oh, wow.
issue with that treatment, however, is that very few places offer it. It tends to be unreasonably expensive, and it's quite a time commitment. So
yeah.
that's fine, of course, if the treatment center happens to be in your local city, but if the treatment center is not in your local city, it can be a big problem.
Do you know if insurance companies will pay for that?
Some will, some won't. Okay. I'm definitely not an insurance expert, so I definitely couldn't comment too much on that. I can say that in Canada, we're moving to a system where more medical plans provincially will cover it, and so I expect that more insurance companies in the States will have to cover it as well.
Okay. Well, we have somebody else. It's Rudy, has a question about hypomania and denial. So let's bring
okay.
Rudy on the phone. Hi, Rudy.
Hi, Natasha. I've been following
Rudy.
You for quite a while. It's Rudy Caceres. Yes, I had a question about hypomania and denial, because I see a lot of people, and including myself, where we start getting into that hypomanic phase, and we're thinking, like, well, this, like, I'm never going to crash. Like, I'm going to feel this way forever. And, like, you start, anyone who tries to tell you that you should take care of yourself, and you start to, like, tell people, like, oh, you're wrong and all that stuff. I want to get your side on that of when about denial in hypomania.
Yeah, so it's, you know, there's a common condition that has a fancy name. It's called anosognosia, which is common in people with schizophrenia, but also happens in people with bipolar disorder, where they literally cannot comprehend their own disorder. They think they don't have one. And this is pretty common in hypomania, because for many people, hypomania feels good. Why in heaven's name would feeling good be any sign of a disorder? That makes no sense at all. And, you know, unfortunately, that is a pretty common problem for us. Now, I combat that problem by using my own personal brand of logic. And I realize that not everyone is as logical as I am, so that's not necessarily going to work for all people. But one of the strategies that can work for people is, for example, after they've crashed this time, whatever time it is, maybe it's the 35th time they've done it, and they're in the crash and they're saying to themselves, why did I do that? I should never have allowed that hypomania to continue because now I'm in this horrible position. The thing that they can do is they can write a letter to themselves and they can say, this is my experience, A, B, C. And the next time this happens, I want to remember the following ABC, whatever it is. And by writing a letter to themselves, that can be a lot more effective than everyone else around them trying to convince them that they need to take care of themselves.
Okay. Thank you. I was just having a conversation with someone recently who just made me feel like it wasn't my place to try to tell someone about that. So it's great that you brought up that advice about having the person try to do it for themselves.
Yeah, we can often convince ourselves of things much better than other people can. And there is, I think, a natural inclination to get angry with other people when they try to give us health advice. Okay, I think that's normal. And so we don't listen very well. But you can't ignore yourself.
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions for Natasha? Oh, okay, he's gone. Sorry. Is he gone, Rudy? Okay. Sorry, Natasha, he's gone. That was very helpful. That was great advice about writing that letter because, as you know, I experienced this in my own family, and what you just said about people getting angry when you try to point out what's going on, that happens.
Yes, absolutely. That's very common. Loved ones often have that experience. I'm sorry to say that that is a very common thing.
Yeah, and very difficult for people who love the other people going through this.
Yeah, the job of a person with bipolar is tough, and the job of their loved ones is also very tough.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So, yeah, writing a letter, that's really great advice. I will make sure for those of the people that I have that haven't listened to the show, I will make sure I share that with them because that's excellent advice. So the other thing I wanted to talk a little bit about with you is the bipolar one where the mania can be so incredible. Can you talk a little bit about that for people who are listening? They can understand more about what that is.
Yeah. So as I said earlier, bipolar mania and bipolar hypomania are actually the same in terms of symptoms. So symptomatically they are the same. However, mania is much more severe. And there are some things that can happen in mania that don't happen in hypomania. We'll talk about that in just a second. But in mania, all kinds of things that can happen and be life-threatening, because we think of mania as being life-threatening and often be in an emergency situation. And that's because you lose your judgment. You lose your ability to actually make good decisions. So even something as simple as crossing the road, if you feel like you're invincible, if you feel like nothing will ever happen to you, if you feel like you're a walking deity, you don't check both ways, do you? Because you don't think anything's ever going to happen to you. And then you get hit by a car, right?
Yeah.
So something as simple as crossing the road can actually be dangerous for a person in mania. And one of the other things that can happen in mania that's really critical to understand is that people who are manic can also suffer from psychosis. And psychosis is the presence of delusions and hallucinations. So delusions are believing things that aren't real, and hallucinations, of course, are having experiences that don't really exist. And that can happen in any of the five senses. So it's something that if a person is manic, they may start believing things that aren't real. Like, for example, is the FBI following me? You know, and then thinking that every black car on the road is evidence that the FBI is following that person. And if you think that the FBI is following you, and let's say you think they're trying to get you for something, maybe you become paranoid, and maybe you start manifesting certain behaviors because you're paranoid. And again, that can be dangerous for you and the people around you. One woman came onto my blog, and she was talking about her experiences with manic psychosis, and she said she believed she could talk to the wind. So with all of her heart, with all of her belief, she believed she could talk to the wind. And so she was driving down the highway, and she opened her car window, she stuck out her arm, and then she closed her eyes and waited for the wind to tell her when to turn. Of course, that's not terribly successful.
Yeah.
And, you know, this woman, thankfully, did get out of this situation. She did get treatment, and she's okay. But just because of that one belief, her life was in danger.
Wow.
So that's you know, just some of the dangers that can happen with mania.
So frightening. It really is.
It can be.
It absolutely can be. Explain something to me, too, because, you know, they try to make it so simple when they write it in the DSM-5, and I think there's so much more to diagnosis than reading in a book. So the really severe depression, that when people are in major depression and they have a plan and they want to kill themselves, and it can that go with hypomania as well?
Yeah, so you can experience a mood either in bipolar type 2 or bipolar type 1 that's called a mixed mood. And in a mixed mood, you experience both the elevated mood and the depressed mood at the same time. So there are symptoms from each mood that happen at the same time. This has actually been in the DSM for many years, but there wasn't a recognition that you could actually get it in bipolar 2.
Right.
Now, however, it is recognized that you can get it in bipolar 2. Mixed moods are possible with a hypomania and a depression component to them. So
okay.
In a mixed mood, you have some of the symptoms of hypomania, some of the symptoms of depression, and they are mixed together. And this actually is one of the most dangerous kind of moods you can have, because what we know is that many people actually do attempt suicide in that kind of mood. Because what happens is you're very, very depressed and suicidal, but you also have all this energy. And so that energy allows you to actually put that plan into motion,
whatever
that plan is. And so it's extremely dangerous. Mixed moods are challenging to treat and extremely dangerous.
Wow. It's amazing. I hadn't even thought about that, but it makes sense when you say it now, when you have that kind of energy. You have the energy to follow through on something that you said you were going to do.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, in depression, you typically have no energy, and so you don't follow through on that plan, thankfully. But unfortunately, you know, you get that energy, and that's the first thing you do, because you're not feeling better. You're just feeling energetic.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, thank you for that explanation. That really helps, and I'm sure a lot of people that are listening, because there's a lot about this disorder that can be very confusing to a lot of people when they ask questions. So having you on the show and you explaining this in really, you know, the kind of language that everybody can understand is just wonderful. I appreciate that. I think we have somebody on for a question. Yes, one second. I think my husband's just taking the information.
Okay.
Yeah. So while we're waiting for him, I do understand. Is he ready for the question? Okay. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. How are you?
Good. How are you? Here's Natasha.
Hi,
Melissa.
Hi. So I was recently diagnosed with bipolar 2 and ADD. And I've been researching it, and there's a lot of symptoms that overlap, and a lot of things that say, you know, you have, you know, that it's misdiagnosed. So how do they figure out that I have both versus just having, like, the ADD and the symptoms are overlapping?
So that's a great question. And I can tell you that people with bipolar disorder do actually have a higher rate of ADD and ADHD than your average population. So if you did have both disorders, it wouldn't be that uncommon.
Okay.
But in order to really tell the difference between those two things, in my mind, the really big difference has to do with mood cycling. So, and Justine, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, because I'm certainly not an ADD expert.
Oh, no, you're doing great.
I would expect that the ADD symptoms would be fairly constant over time, whereas I would expect your bipolar symptoms to be elevated and depressed depending on your cycle. So that would be the big difference for me, is are you seeing this highly elevated mood and this highly depressed mood in cycles, and are you seeing an ADD symptomology that's fairly static?
Yes, I was seeing that, yeah. That was definitely how I was going.
Yeah, so that to me sounds like you may have both disorders. That would be how I would look at it.
Okay. And then currently for the bipolar, I've been treated with Lexapro and gabapentin. Is that a common combination of medication to treat the bipolar too?
I definitely wouldn't call that a common combination. Gabapentin actually isn't that common of a medication in that class. There are actually more common medications in that class, so that's a bit unusual. And as far as Lexapro goes, well, that's an antidepressant, and there are, you know, so many antidepressants to choose from. You know, it's hard to say which one is right for you, other than your doctor, you know, looks at your history and takes a good guess.
Correct.
So I wouldn't call that a common combination, but what matters, of course, is that it works for you. So if that combination is working for you, it doesn't matter if you're the only one on the entire planet in that combination.
Right. Okay. Okay,
does
thank
it seem
you very
to be
much.
Working for you, Melissa?
Sort of. I'm actually the one, I go to your group therapy session.
Yes.
Okay.
Just
yeah,
seen.
I know. I recognized you.
Okay. it sort of seems to be working. I still have I tend to have a lot of anxiety, and this has kind of been recently diagnosed, and I've been suffering from these symptoms for a long time, for years. So the anxiety is now what I'm trying to kind of overcome. And so it's a combination of things. I think so far it seems to be working out for me, but sometimes I wonder if there's a different combination of medication that would be better for me.
And it's always difficult to say that. What I do tell people, like, there are lots of treatments for anxiety. Anxiety is totally treatable, both with a cognitive therapy type of treatment or with a medication type of treatment. Anxiety is very common in bipolar disorder, so you're not alone. That's a very common thing. So, you know, lots and lots of people, myself included, do struggle with anxiety along with their bipolar. So it may be a tweaking in your medication, and I do mean a tweak. You know, it might be an increase of the dose of one of those meds. That may be all it takes for you to get a handle on that anxiety. Or it might be worth your time and your effort to go and take some cognitive behavioral therapy with an actual therapist and have them help address that anxiety.
Yeah, I'm doing that as well. I'm trying to get all under control.
Well,
so,
that's
Melissa,
great. That's
really
good to hear.
I just wanted to mention that you had been on Vyvanse, correct?
Correct.
All right.
And
Natasha, what happened was her anxiety went way up on the Vyvanse?
Yeah.
But now, Natasha, they put her on Strattera.
Okay.
And I guess I just want to ask you a question, Natasha. I was concerned when I heard that because of the bipolar, if she's already on an antidepressant and then we add the Strattera, which kind of works the same way, is there a danger there of increasing a manic episode?
So there's definitely always a concern when you add any kind of, I'm going to call it an upper drug. I don't mean that in a street term, but any kind of elevating drug. There definitely is a concern that it can induce a mania, a hypomania, or mixed state, or even a switching of states. So it can induce one of those things. However, because in her case she's also on the gabapentin, the gabapentin helps to actually take away that risk.
Okay.
So it will depend on her personally, but the gabapentin is what sort of balances that out.
So that's a mood stabilizer drug?
That's correct.
Like Lamictal?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good.
That's right.
Okay, great. Anything else, Melissa, for Natasha?
No, that's it. Thank you very much. That really explaining the medications and how they work, that makes a lot of sense, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Happy
Thanks
to
for
help.
Calling.
Thank you.
Okay, that was great. Yeah, thank you. Because I know that she's been concerned about that, and that's very helpful. Because this is, as I said before, a lot of people, this is such a mystery to so many people, trying to figure out what's going on and how to feel better. How to feel better is, so incredible.
You know,
go ahead.
I just think back to when I was first diagnosed. I actually was incorrectly diagnosed, like many people. I was diagnosed with minor depression at the time. And at the time, I actually knew the doctor was wrong. I actually had done a lot of research, and I felt very strongly that he was wrong. But because I was so severely depressed, I had no ability to speak up for myself at that time.
So sad.
So I really understand why people are in that situation, because when you're sick, you are least capable of standing up for yourself, and yet it is at the time when it is most critical. So I completely understand why people are there. And I also know that at the time I had no understanding of medication, and the explanation that my doctor gave me was the typical chemical imbalance theory, which was outmoded in the 70s. And so he just did that, in my opinion, because it was easy for him. It was easy for him to explain an outmoded theory to me so that I would be a willing patient and take the medication, when, in fact, I'm a person who likes facts and not something that is merely easy to understand. And I respond much better to things that are research-based and not, you know, a random drawing, which is what he did. So I understand why medication is so confusing. You get conflicting information. It's really tough. I really feel for people in that situation. But, it, you know, you can work through it. It does happen.
Yeah, and I think, like you said before, being able to go into the psychiatrist with a list of questions that you have or feelings that you're having about what you're on, and you know, I don't know how you feel about this, but I think that if I had bipolar disorder, I would definitely be keeping a daily diary of how I'm feeling.
So we call those mood journals, right?
And
mood journals can be very useful in bipolar disorder for your own sake as well as for your doctor's sake. And there are some mood journals actually that are designed to be exported and sent to your psychiatrist.
Wow.
So some psychiatrists will actually take that information into consideration and do actually want to see it from their patients. So if you're one of the people who's finding that you need to track your moods on a daily basis because they're switching up and you can't, you know, it's so long in between appointments with your doctor that you can't remember everything that's happened, again, completely normal, writing it down and making that mood journal is definitely a tool that can absolutely work. There's a mood tracker that is called the T2 mood tracker. So T as in the letter T and 2 as in the number 2. I don't have anything to do with it. I'm not paid to endorse it. I just like it. To be clear, I just think it's a good piece of software. So that particular piece of software is a mood tracker, and what it does is it tracks your mood on many different scales. So things like anxiety, things like depression, things like mania, all that stuff is broken down into symptoms, and each of those symptoms are tracked, and then they're graphed for you.
So you can see,
for example, of the, you know, 8 symptoms of anxiety that I'm tracking, for example, am I going up? Am I going down? Am I staying the same? You know, how does that relate to my depression? If my anxiety goes up, does my depression go up? You know, does my hypomania go up?
Wow.
What's going on? So you can draw those kind of relationships when you see it in a graph.
Tell me something, Natasha. Where do people get this from?
So that piece of software is available for your phone, either on the iPhone or the Android. So you can get it from either the iTunes store or the Android store. They both have them, and they're free.
Oh, that's wonderful. And it's called the T2 Mood Tracker.
Mood Tracker. That's right. It's actually done by a company that's out of the Veterans Administration. So the piece of software was actually designed for people with PTSD specifically. But there's no reason why someone with bipolar disorder can't utilize that as well. And I actually have 2 articles on my blog about that particular piece of software because I do like it.
Oh, wow. And can you tell everybody how they can get to your blog?
Yeah, you can find me at natashatracy.com. Or you can always just Google my name or the bipolar burble.
Okay. Yeah, because I just want people to know, even though I have it written down, sometimes, you know, they miss it. And this way you saying it is a lot better. So do you yourself use this T2 mood tracker?
I have used it for, I don't use it currently, but I have used it for months on end to find patterns in my own cycles. So I'm the kind of person, I love a graph. Maybe I'm the only one, but I love a good graph that tells me how depressed I am. That's just
great.
Me for you. And so I have used it. And the thing about this particular piece of software is it will allow you to put in custom variables to track as well. So if you have a symptom that's really important to you but isn't listed there, they'll let you make a custom one so that you can track it as well.
Wow, that's wonderful.
It's great.
That is really exciting. I'm going to tell a lot of people about this because this is really a great idea. I love it because I think people, just like you said before, you started out with self-awareness being the most important piece of this.
Yes.
This can help with self-awareness.
Absolutely. I totally agree. I totally agree.
Yeah, so that's really exciting. Can we talk for a minute a little bit about holistic? I know that you talk a lot about NAC. Is that's a vitamin or I don't know how you would classify it.
Supplement. Yeah, so that's a supplement.
Can you tell people about that?
Yeah, so that's a supplement called N-acetylcysteine, which I know is a big word, but people just typically call it NAC, N-A-C. And your doctor will know about this. There is actually research that talks about adding NAC to an existing treatment plan can help ease depression. So it's something that you can get either by prescription or over the counter, depending on where you are. And it's just a supplement. When I checked with my doctor, there were literally no side effects listed in her database for it. That may have changed. Do make sure to talk to your doctor. I'm not saying you shouldn't. You absolutely should. But talk to them about it. And the only downside of this particular supplement is that it can take a long time to work. Because it is not concentrated like a medication is, you're likely going to see benefits in the term of months rather than in the term of weeks.
Okay. Well,
I do like it because it's inexpensive and because of the lack of side effects. That's the reason why I like it. But there are the downsides as well.
Is there anything else from a holistic or vitamin supplement or amino acid that you would suggest?
We do know that omega-3s are effective at treating depression and bipolar disorder. There's definitely research on that as well. Again, your doctor will know about that. There are omega-3s available by prescription. Those are, if you have coverage and if you have the ability to get them, that is the best thing to take because...
I didn't even know that. That's great.
It is controlled by the FDA, so you know exactly what you're getting in the pill. When you buy it as a supplement, say at the drugstore, it's not regulated, and you don't really know what you're getting in the pill. So I do recommend getting it by prescription if you can. If you can't, of course, it is available in your drugstore. You do have to know how much to take, and it's a lot. So oftentimes in the drugstore brands, you have to take like 10 to 12 pills a day in order for it to be effective. So that's another reason why the prescription one is good. Because you only have to take the two pills. But for more information on omega-3 and bipolar 2, I would go to a website called Psych Education. And I'm trying to remember if it's .com or .org. He has it's run by a doctor. Yeah, it's psycheducation.org. It's run by a doctor and Dr. Jim Phelps. He's an amazing bipolar expert, and he runs down the evidence on omega-3s and bipolar depression.
Wow. I love that. That's great. Because there's a lot of people who don't kind of push back against the omegas. I'm a big believer in them. I think they're wonderful. But I never knew. You taught me something today. I didn't know that they come in prescription strength.
Yes. Yes.
That's great.
I do. And, you know, the thing about omega-3s is, I mean, hopefully you get an antidepressant response with them. That's the ideal. But even if for some reason you didn't, they are good for your brain in general. You know, so it's not, there's no real negative to taking them as far as I know. But again, talk to your doctor.
So can I ask you something, like, I know you keep saying about the doctor, and I agree, everybody should talk to their doctor, but how many milligrams would you say for somebody who can't get a prescription filled? What
so
kind of milligrams?
If I remember correctly, I believe it's a gram. So it's 1,000 milligrams a day.
Okay.
If I remember correctly. So I'm going to double check that right now because I don't want to put out anything that's incorrect. Because I believe in studies they were taking up to a gram. I believe that was the case.
Okay. Okay.
So, yes. Just one second here. I'm just trying to okay. Yes. So in so it's up to a gram. I was correct. It's up to a gram per day. So
okay.
That's why it takes so many pills in an over-the-counter form.
Right. Right. Yeah, because you want to get the both. There's two kinds of omegas, right? There's.
Yep.
Yeah. So you want to get both at 1,000.
Well, the studies that they did, they just did omega-3 fatty acids. With at least 60% EPA. I'm not an expert on that, but that was what they specifically did studies on. So in that case, it was one medication. It was one pill. In some, like, so in some studies, they did fish oil, which obviously is going to include more than that one particular concentrate. But in general, it's EPA that they studied.
Okay, that's great. Thank you for that, because I'm sure a lot of people are interested in this. And I remember the last time that you were on, one of the things that we had agreed upon talking about, but we didn't get there, is meditation and mindfulness, because I'm such a follower and I love, I mean, I do it every day. So
right.
I know you do too. So can you talk about, please, because I have so many people in the world of ADHD that tell me it doesn't help, I don't want to do it, I can't do it, I can't. Can you please tell people how helpful this is?
So meditation and mindfulness can be extremely helpful for people, particularly with anxiety. That anxiety and stress, those are like the number one things that I see. I was in a group for it. I was in a, I was in specifically a group that taught mindfulness meditation. And the people in the group who found it most useful were the people with anxiety and stress issues. And I would have to say lots of us do suffer with that, and certainly people with ADHD might suffer from it, just like people with bipolar.
Yeah.
Also, of course, when you're in that highly elevated mood, that mindfulness meditation may help in bringing you down where you want to be, right? So it can be very useful in multiple ways. Now, I think of mindfulness as something that I personally do every second of the day, which is very hard, and I'm not suggesting that everyone can do this. But basically, it's very simply put, living in the here and now. Not yesterday, not tomorrow, only today. So that means you do things like you don't worry about the future. Tomorrow's going to take care of itself. It'll be there when you wake up. And you don't worry about the past. It's gone. There's nothing that you can do about it. It's time for you to live in the present. That's what I would consider to be the simplest version of mindfulness.
Yes.
And mindfulness meditation is very much the same. It's basically focusing your brain and your mind on only the present. Now, I personally do this by counting. I'm not saying that that's the best technique
that's
for
great.
Everyone, but personally, I like to close my eyes, I like to relax, and I do a progressive muscle relaxation. Very common in meditation, where I progressively relax every muscle in my every muscle group in my body, and then I start counting, and I will count to 100, and then I'll start again. And sometimes when my brain I find it wandering, I find it going off on other tangents, I bring it back to the counting, and then I actually picture the numbers in my head as I go along.
Excellent.
So to specifically keep me exactly where I am, I think about the number, I picture the number, and then I move on to the next number. And I know that sounds really simple, but it's just about giving your brain that focus of the moment, for the moment. And the thing that I think is really important for people to realize is that the brain will wander. Your
mm-hmm.
mind will wander. It's what brains do, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The meditation teacher who taught us said, your brain thinks. That's what it was designed to do, now and forever. So the fact that it goes off on tangents is not a failure on your part. The only thing you need to do is bring it back to the present moment. You didn't do anything wrong. It's totally normal and natural. You just want to bring it back to the present moment. That's it.
Yes, and the other thing with the thoughts that I've learned myself is not to resist them, just to let them come up, but don't engage.
I totally agree. You know, they often
yeah.
use a metaphor of a cloud in the sky. You watch your thought come, and you watch it pass you by, just like a
right.
cloud. That's
mm-hmm.
all you have to do. And it takes
So there's somebody on the phone that needs you to repeat the name of a supplement she mentioned before, and I don't know, does she want to come on the phone?
Yeah.
Okay, can you click her on? Hi, Deb.
Hi. I just had a question about the supplement you were talking about that takes a long time to work. I thought you said NAC, or I really couldn't quite understand what you said.
Yeah, so I said N as in Nancy, A as in Adam, C as in candy. So NAC, people usually just pronounce it NAC.
Okay.
And I do have information on that supplement on my website at natashatracy.com so that you can learn more about it if you want. And the big long name for it is N-acetylcysteine. That's the big long name for it.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yeah, no problem.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
Bye. We have somebody else waiting on the line? Okay. Okay. Hi, Narissa.
Hi there. Hi, Natasha. So I was, my question was, I was diagnosed with bipolar 2 years ago. I haven't had consistent health care. I was on this lithium for a while, maybe like 3 months, and I started hallucinating, so I went off of it. Then I lost my job. I've had 40-something jobs, and I'm 37 years old, so my life has been a constant roller coaster. But I'm not sure if I am bipolar. There is mental illness in my family with schizophrenia, but I don't have the depression and manic episodes like a month at a time. It's always just like back and forth. It's like a roller coaster. So I'm wondering,
yeah.
have you, is that... Is that consistent with people who have bipolar?
So for you, how long might a mood episode last?
Maybe a week to 2 weeks.
So if your mood episode, either depression or hypomania or mania, whichever one it is for you, lasts for more than a few days, that definitely falls into the category of bipolar disorder. You're not a standard person with bipolar disorder because your moods aren't lasting quite as long, but you still have a variant called rapid cycling bipolar disorder.
Mm. Okay.
Does that
make
sense?
It's been really hard. You know, I've actually started claiming, I got filed a disability claim just recently because it's just an ongoing situation where I lose jobs and I can't maintain relationships. My whole life has just been up and down. And I just keep on chugging away, trying to, you know, find ways to, you know, just calming myself down, like you were talking about, listening, mm-hmm. meditating and stuff like that. So that's where I'm at now. My next step is trying to get medication again.
Yep.
And, that last time I had lithium and that didn't work. So I have to, let them know my history so I could get the correct medication.
Yeah, I mean, lithium is is a big gun in the world of bipolar disorder treatment for sure, and many doctors will go to it first as a first-line treatment, but it's not the only treatment. There are many, many more out there, and rapid cycling can be tougher to treat than your average cycling bipolar person, but I'm rapid cycling, so are a lot of people, and it absolutely can be done.
Okay. All right.
Thank you
for
calling.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks.
You have a great day.
Thank you.
So, Natasha, bye. Melissa's back. She has another question for you about insomnia, which I think would be a great question
for
everybody who's listening, too. So we're going to put her on again.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Hi, Melissa.
Hi. So I've suffered with insomnia off and on throughout these years, and I've tried melatonin, which, you know, some people say is good, some people say is bad. I've tried different prescription medications. Do you have any suggestions? What would be the best thing to help with insomnia if I don't have to take another prescription? Maybe a supplement or just some, I don't know, some different. Because I've tried also listening to, music and stuff, and that doesn't always help.
Yeah, so I have problems with getting to sleep myself. And so what I have to do is I have to have really good sleep hygiene.
Okay.
So sleep hygiene is this concept of all the habits that you have around sleep, and they really have to all align to help facilitate your sleep. I've written about this as well at natashatracy.com. There's more information there. But some of the things that you can think about for sleep hygiene is to go to bed at the same time every night, to wake up at the same time every morning. So no matter what is going on, you never sleep in, not ever.
Okay.
You set yourself a pattern and you stick to it.
Okay.
And then you do other things. Like, for example, don't do anything in your bedroom except for sleeping and, of course, sex. Those are the things that you do in your bedroom, and you don't do anything else. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to train your brain so that it says, every time I enter this room, I'm going to sleep. That's what you're trying to do. So you're trying to facilitate your own brain's connection with your bedroom and sleep. You also want to do things like make sure your bed is comfortable, make sure your bedroom is pitch black, make sure that it's at a lower temperature. You want it to be cool in there and not warm. Those are, as well, you want to have a routine before you go to bed that is the same routine that you do every single night. And that routine is up to you. Maybe it's, brush your teeth. Maybe it's, brush your hair. Maybe it's have a shower. I mean, whatever it is for you, the important part is having a routine before you go to bed. And one other thing that I do want to mention that you may not have tried is to block blue light an hour before bed. Blue light is a type of light that comes off of things like electronics and home lighting, and it's a type of light that comes off the sun. And so when your brain perceives blue light, it thinks to itself, I need to be awake now. And so if you block blue light, then it helps your brain to think that it's time to go to sleep. And so you can block blue light either by not having any lights on and not having your TV or computer on. That's not necessarily all that reasonable for people. But the other thing you can do is you can buy blue light blocking glasses from Amazon. They're not very expensive. They're used for light welding. I always tell people when they see them that I use it for my light welding jobs. But that's what they're actually for. So they're orange in color, the glasses, and they will block blue light so that you can watch TV and not get harmed by the blue light. So I do recommend picking yourself up a pair. Like I said, they're not very expensive, and all you have to do is wear them for an hour before bed, and I swear to you, it makes a difference in your brain.
Wow. That's so interesting. I'm going to get a pair.
It's
great.
It's a simple thing. I can't promise that it will work, but, when you take all of the sleep hygiene things and you put them together, it's like, building up your army against something, and they all work together to help you facilitate that sleep.
It's great. Such a great idea.
Thank you very much.
Do you have anything else, Melissa, you want to talk about?
No, that's it right now. She's answered. Okay. She's done a tremendous job already. So thank you.
I know. Thank you, Melissa. Thanks.
Take care, honey.
Thanks.
Bye. Yeah, I think for people with ADHD as well, sleep is always been an issue. So these glasses would be a great idea for a lot of people who insist on looking at their computer. Can we use
right.
them to look at the computer, too, before we go to bed?
Yes, you can. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's such a great idea. And since they're cheap, that's even better.
Yes, and I cannot take credit for this idea. I did not come up with it. Dr. Jim Phelps, the guy who runs psycheducation.org, he's the
okay.
one who wrote about it originally, and he's the one who actually, I mean, it was the research that he brought forward that actually made me come to this particular conclusion. So I can't take all the credit for it, but I can take credit for spreading it wildly.
Yes, and this is perfect. You've spread it on here. So you use it to watch TV when you have them on?
I do, yeah. Yep,
wow.
I do
okay.
it so that I can watch TV and have like a house light on, although I do try to keep the lights off once it's an hour before bed for me. I try to get everything as off as I can, but the fact
okay.
of the matter is I do watch TV before bed, and those glasses do help with that.
Okay, this is great. It really does help a lot because I have, you know, also kids with ADHD that I see, and they want to stay up and they want to play video games, and I'm always talking about what you talked about last year with that blue light thing and how it tricks your brain, the circadian clock.
Yep.
So now
yep.
we have a way for them to stay up and play their video games, which is great.
Yeah, video
like
games
that.
Might not be the best thing to do because
I
of
know.
The activity in your brain, but maybe
right.
they could watch some TV instead.
Yes, we could do that.
Not that I'm advocating that you sit around watching TV, I'm just saying.
I know. You want to keep them off the video games, too. But, you know, sometimes after doing a whole night of homework, they need a little bit of excitement. So maybe even a half an hour with the glasses on.
Yep,
I
get that.
I think we have somebody else on the line that wants to ask a question. So,
okay.
Oh, Rudy's on again. Okay. Hi, Rudy.
Hi. I didn't mean to end so abruptly last time, but I did have a question about energy, because oftentimes when I'm depressed and other people with bipolar, that you don't have energy for everything, and people tell you, oh, you need to go get some exercise, that'll make you feel better with the endorphins or everything. But how is it possible to will yourself to do these kind of things when you're so depressed and feel like you have absolutely no energy at all?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and it's
yeah.
something that I personally battle with for sure. I am not a good person for exercising. I'll just admit it right now. I'm not good about it. But here's the thing that I have learned, and it was from the head honcho at Harvard Research in Bipolar. He said, here's the exercise plan that I give to my bipolar patients. He said, walk in any direction for 7.5 minutes, turn around, walk back. That's it. He said, it's something that pretty much anyone can handle, and it will make a difference over the course of a year. That's what he said. Now, obviously, sure, we'd love it if everyone with bipolar disorder would do some sort of a speed walk that was maybe a mile every day or something like that. Yeah, sure. But that's not very reasonable for most people. So I've always liked what he had to say about walking for 7.5 minutes, because you know what? That's like walking around the block once. I can do
mm-hmm.
that. That's attainable for me. So what I believe is that you start in tiny, tiny little baby steps. And if you feel like 7.5 minutes is too much for you, I totally get it. So you know what you might do? You might walk, you know, if you're in an apartment building, which is what I am, maybe you walk down a set of stairs and up a set of stairs and you do it once. Maybe that's what you start with, and maybe that's okay for you. Maybe you walk out to your mailbox and walk back. Maybe that's good for you. And, sorry, excuse me. And basically, it's about baby steps. It's about starting with something tiny, doable, and attainable, and not saying to yourself, I'm going to run a marathon, because you're not. So maybe in a year you'll run a marathon. I don't know, but you're not going to do it tomorrow. So that's sort of my advice on that.
No, thank you, because oftentimes you end up doing nothing because you think like you have to do something like that, and then like you start gaining more weight, and then when you gain weight, it's like it makes it even harder to exercise because then it's like you're battling against your body weight. So thank you for that advice, and that's something I definitely need to work on.
Yep, you and me both.
Yes. So I'm glad. Thank you for answering my questions, and I'm glad you're on here having this show. So have a great day.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
Bye. Yeah, no, that's really good advice. People with ADHD have that issue with follow through. So
yep.
And we also have we live in extremes. So it's like we say we're going to walk 4 miles tomorrow morning, which is just ridiculous. And we don't do anything.
Right.
So I love seven and a half minutes. What is he saying?
That's right.
Can I ask you, what did he say is going to happen in a year?
I believe that a doctor did the calculations, and it's something like if people would walk for 15 minutes a day instead of sitting for 15 minutes a day, over the course of the year, they would lose 2 pounds or something.
Wow.
Rather than gaining 2 pounds. It's something like that. So it's actually not this massive change to your health, and no one thinks it's going to be, but it's positive.
Yeah, which is what everybody needs.
That's right.
Something positive. So let's talk about that energy issue with the depression. You know, there are people that just struggle with depression. They don't have bipolar, but they also have depression, and that's one of the co-occurring disorders with ADHD. And so I wonder about, is there something that people with depression, bipolar or other kinds of depression, can do to get their energy level up, besides if they're on meds and it's still not helping?
Yeah, so that's a really hard one, and I battle it all the time. So my personal strategies here, I do think that moving can be helpful, i.e. your 7.5 minutes. I do think that that can be helpful for two reasons. One is it does get you off the couch, which is great, but two, you can feel like you've accomplished something that day. And that sense of accomplishment can actually propel you to do other things.
Wow.
So
yeah.
I actually think that exercise is valuable in even that small dose. I think it's valuable in getting your energy up. You know, studies on exercise focus on aerobic activity. And I just want to tell these guys, when I'm depressed, the chance of me doing aerobics is about the same as me climbing Mount Everest. Like, it's never, ever, ever going to happen. So I'm really glad if other people can do it, but I can't. So
I'm really glad to hear you say that because, you know, you're so well-respected and people just love you. So to hear you say something like that, it helps other people to feel normal. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you're depressed, you can't get up, you can't go exercise. Well, Natasha Tracy says she has the same issue. I'm okay. I'm not.
Yes, it is,
know,
okay.
People,
it is okay. It is okay. I swear it's very normal. And the other thing that, like, for me, I have to rest a lot. And I don't like this about myself, but it is true. I do spend, now I have the luxury, of course, of working at home for the majority of the time as a writer and a speaker, but it's not, you know, I will work for a certain number of hours, and then I will rest for an hour, and then I'll get up and do another hour of work, and then I'll rest for another hour. And I realize not everyone is going to have that luxury, of course, but I do think you can rest throughout the day. That actually can be really good for your energy instead of trying to essentially, you know, squeeze blood from a stone. If you're trying to make yourself move and do stuff and you can't because you're so tired, chances are you're not going to be paying attention to detail, you're not going to do a good job, and you're just going to feel worse. So take a break, stop what you're doing, and rest. If that's, you know, 15 minutes with your eyes closed at your desk, believe me, I've done it before, then that's what that is. It depends on who you are and your circumstance, but I'm a big believer in rest.
So would you also suggest that if somebody is sitting at a desk all day long that possibly they get up and take a walk? Could that also help with energy level? Like,
well, I would love that. If everyone did their 7.5 minutes at their lunch hour, I think their afternoons would go more smoothly. Because, of course, what tends to happen is we tend to eat lunch and then we get into a blood sugar low in the afternoon, and that makes us feel crappy.
Yeah.
And that's on top of whatever's going on for us in our brains.
Right.
So, yeah, if you can do your 7.5 minutes at lunch or on a break, that would be super.
Right. Now, I have a question about, we have a few minutes left, and it's about bipolar disorder and OCD. I've met a lot of people that have the two together. Do you see that?
Yeah, that is actually has been found in the literature as well. There is quite an overlap of OCD and bipolar disorder, so more people have OCD who have bipolar than in the general population. We do actually see that.
Okay.
And even if you don't have official OCD, I personally have found that obsessive compulsive tendencies are extremely common in people with bipolar.
Really?
Yes.
Why do
so
you think?
So I myself tend to be obsessive and compulsive about certain things. I wouldn't consider myself to have OCD. I wouldn't say that. But I would say that I have traits that definitely fall along those lines. I tend to be obsessed about things mentally. I'll have something that I can't stop thinking about no matter what I do, no matter where I go. It doesn't matter. You know, I might get obsessed about a person, for example, which is really bad for them. But you know, I swear I'm not a stalker, but it can happen that I get obsessed thinking about a person. And things like compulsions, you know, there are things in my house that have to be a certain way. It's like everything else can be in chaos, but if there are certain things that are exactly how I want them, that's important to me for whatever reason. So I wouldn't say I have OCD, but I would say that I have those tendencies. And I do think that people with bipolar do have them. And I actually have written about obsessive bipolar thoughts in an article called How a Person with Bipolar Thinks. It's actually the most popular article on the site. Thousands and thousands of people have read it. In fact, it just got ripped off by two other sites this week. But anyway.
Ripped off? They copied it?
Yeah.
That's
really
terrible.
Starting to get ticked about it, too. Yeah. But so I have written about obsessive bipolar thoughts, and I do think that, you know, for example, rumination, when you're depressed and all you can think about is how depressed you are, that is called rumination and is also a form of an obsessive thought pattern, because all you can do is think about one thing all the time, and that's depression or that's suicide or that's, you know, whatever it is for you personally. So I think there is a lot of crossover there.
So it's so difficult, I'm sure, you know, for people that have those ruminations. It's got to be terrible. Yeah.
It's awful, right?
Yeah.
You want to break your thought pattern, but your brain's not letting you, basically.
And see, that's something that's interesting, because that OCD, people who have real OCD, and my younger son, without the bipolar, has that, and he'll say to me that he gets angry how people romance OCD, like joking about washing your hands, because he said the kind of OCD that I have is really serious. I mean, the thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the ruminations. And I don't think a lot of people really get that. Yeah.
Right, and that's why I'm really clear in saying I have those traits, but I don't have that disorder, because I don't want to romanticize that disorder either. OCD can be very serious. It can lock people in their houses to the point where they never see another human being. This is not a minor event. So it absolutely can be serious, just like bipolar disorder can be serious. So, no, I definitely agree with your son. It should not be romanticized.
No, I agree too, So, yeah, I mean, I just had to ask that because I do know a lot of people that struggle with OCD along with bipolar, and now that you say that, it may not even be that they have OCD, but as you're saying, they have some of the symptoms of it, where they have some compulsions, they have some obsessions, but it's not 100% of the time where they can't, they just can't do anything. Like, they're such
That's
a perfectionist, they can't move forward at all. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, having bipolar is difficult enough. Then you have the other things on top of it.
Yeah, and, you know, it's the same thing with anxiety. You know, bipolar is hard enough, and then you pile on some anxiety. It's, you know, it's pretty tough. And so many of us, you know, it's actually more common to have a comorbid disorder, so a second disorder with your bipolar, than it is to not have a second disorder. So most of us are actually battling more than one disorder at a time. A lot of people, for a lot of people, that's a substance use disorder, but there are many
right.
others as well, of course.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think we have somebody that just called in. Yes. Amanda. Okay. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Natasha. How are you?
I'm doing well, Amanda. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing all right. Thank you. I do have a question.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, I also, about the obsessive compulsive disorder you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, because I do have bipolar disorder myself, I'm wondering if, because every morning when I wake up, I'm having just random thoughts as soon as I just wake up. I'm thinking of songs, could be a different genre, all different kinds of stuff. I'm wondering if that has anything to do with OCD as well.
So you're talking about the randomness of your thoughts in the morning?
In the morning and usually throughout the day, I'll just, you know, have those thoughts that just tend to go by, and most of the time I'm just being pretty mindful. I'm going through a lot of therapy and whatnot for my
right.
disorder. I'm wondering if that has anything to do with OCD as well.
I've definitely never heard of it being related to OCD. So typically when you have odd random thoughts that occur, like you are normally being mindful but you have an odd random thought, I would consider that actually just to be pretty normal. None of us, I believe, can be mindful all the time. We are
right.
imperfect human beings, and our brains are constantly thinking of chaotic things. So I would say that you experiencing those random thoughts and not necessarily being able to maintain your mindfulness, you know, all the time, I would consider that to be pretty normal, my opinion.
Oh, okay. So, like, for yourself, you've never had anything like, because it happens every morning. Every morning I wake up and, you know, I'm obviously you're sleeping throughout the night, but as soon as I wake up, I just have, you know, just some random, you know, say country song or rock song stuck in my head, and then it'll go away like 5 minutes later. And about every morning.
Yeah, that may just be the way your brain wakes up in the morning and just the process that your brain goes through. And, you know, if it's not causing you distress, then I would just say that's just a normal part of who you are.
Ah, okay, yeah, because ever since I've been diagnosed, I've had that issue. So I don't know. Kind of strange. I just figured I would call and ask you about it.
Yeah, well, thank you for
you.
Doing that.
Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you, Natasha.
Thanks.
So we're going to have to end, Natasha. This hour and a half went by so fast. It's so great to have you on. I hope we can get you on again. I really appreciate
Thank
it.
You so much.
I appreciate you coming on, and you have so much information. So what's next on the horizon for you before we end?
Next on the horizon for me, it's always so hard to tell because things sort of come up and I jump on them. I'm one of those people that I don't have a 10-year plan. I don't have a 5-year plan. I don't really have a month plan. So I'm not quite sure. I am going to Toronto next week to meet someone that I may enter. The National Benefits Authority is the name of the company.
Okay.
And they work with people to get disability in Canada. That's what they do.
Great.
And so I'm going to meet with them. They're flying me out to have some discussions with them. You know, I will have to see where that goes.
Great.
Know, obviously, keeping up with my writing. You can find me at my blog. You can also find me at healthyplace.com, where I do
okay.
a lot of writing as well. And, yeah, I'm just going to keep on keeping on. And I'm hoping to do more and interesting speaking engagements as well throughout the years. And that's what I'm hoping for.
Great. Thank you so much for being on again. I really appreciate it. And we're going to have you
Thank
back
you.
On again, because I know everybody
great.
Loves you. So have a
oh,
great
you're
night.
So sweet.
Thank
you.
You
too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So we want to thank Natasha Tracy for being on the show. I thank everybody for listening. We will not be on next week. We will be on the week after that with Eric Tivers. I look forward to that show. he and I are going to be talking about vulnerability, which is one of my favorite topics. So I want everybody to stay in the moment. Have a great rest of the Sunday. And thanks again for listening to the show.